From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's Russ Murphy, founder of the Delaware 912 Patriots at Christine O'Donnell's victory rally.
Hello, Patriots. How are we doing tonight? I guess most of y'all know who Karl Rove is. About a year ago, Karl Rove came to Delaware for a Republican thing, and he asked for a private meeting with the Tea Party groups, the grassroots groups, and he tried to convince us how we needed to get behind the candidate that was electable. And I said, sir, with all due respect, no one is going to tell us how to take care of business. That is the people. And you have spoken. Thank you.
There's a word that's overused every political season, and I'm going to use it again. Narrative. What is the prevailing narrative? The answer is usually determined by pundits and politicians after testing the political wind, like Karl Rove speaking to Fox's Sean Hannity about O'Donnell on election night.
It does conservatives little good to support candidates who, at the end of the day, while they may be conservative in their public statements, do not evince the characteristics of rectitude and truthfulness and sincerity and character that the voters are looking for.
Rove knows how to count votes, and polls suggest that roughly 25% of Americans support the Tea Party movement, roughly half of the 46% of the people who voted for John McCain in 2008. But the Tea Party says it represents the majority, and after this primary night, the Tea Party wrested control of the narrative. That's good enough for commentators like Fox's Megyn Kelly and Lars Larson.
They put an honest-to-God conservative in, and then you see the Delaware party say we're not going to support our party's nominee. Thank goodness John Cornyn at the national level has said that the national party will be supporting her.
Probably thousands of phone calls from angry Republicans who said you better reverse your position.
The mainstream media, and let's concede that Fox is part of it, jawboned about the power of the people as evinced by the Tea Party wins on Tuesday. Rush Limbaugh summed up the plot line, his usual plot line, actually, but this time it really took off.
It really is Washington versus the country. I can't tell you, my email started going nuts.
Why did it take off? To be sure, Limbaugh provided a megaphone to amplify the message, and it reverberated on Fox, articulated here in a message from Sarah Palin to her political progeny.
Get out there, speak to the American people, speak through Fox News.
But the buzz over the Tea Party is not, at its heart, a Fox or talk radio creation. The midterm election is evidence of the exponentially growing power and influence of social media. As you'll hear, in a world of Twitter and Facebook, tech-savvy ideologues can do what presidents have always dreamed of: ignore the filter of the so-called mainstream media.
The Tea Party, of course, is not a registered political party, and most of its members vote as Republicans. But even so, the movement takes priority, and its adherents proudly proclaim their freedom from top-down directives. It is no surprise, therefore, that Twitter has become the go-to method of communication for many Tea Partiers. Ken Vogel covers the Tea Party for Politico. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you, Bob.
Now, in addition to Twitter, Tea Partiers use all kinds of online media to organize themselves. Give me a sense of the landscape.
Well, they definitely use Facebook, Ning, which is a lesser-known social network, but is really the homepage for a lot of these local Tea Party groups. You have huge email lists. Then you have national groups like Tea Party Patriots, which is really just a coalition of local groups, and Freedom Works, run by Dick Armey, the former House Majority Leader, that have upwards of 500,000 emails on their address list. You have internet-based free conference call services that are used to hold weekly conference calls that routinely attract sometimes hundreds of local Tea Party organizers.
These social media are very much lattice-like networks, non-hierarchical, grassroots, interconnected, etc. Is that a coincidence?
It's not at all, Bob. They really cling fiercely to this idea that they're leaderless. They've started embracing and recommending to each other this business book called The Starfish and the Spider. And it has a really attractive thesis, which is that poorly funded groups loosely organized around basic shared ideas can change society, often by outmaneuvering more top-down structures. And the use of social media plays very strongly into that idea.
there's a lot of mythology that courses through these various Tea Party social networks, let's say the subject of the president's birth, for example. Does this kind of communication structure encourage people to constantly revalidate their own misinformation?
There's certainly an element of that. You see it with the death panels, an idea that Sarah Palin put forth. However, I don't think that you see that any more so in the Tea Party than you do in any other social media-based communities, where I do think you see a significant disadvantage in the Tea Party of having this decentralized social media-based structure is infighting. These groups just split off from one another.
Everybody fighting for their own version of ideological purity.
There's certainly some element of that, but you also see it over strategy, whether they should endorse candidates or not endorse candidates, at what level they should get involved. And you do see a fair amount of petty personality-based fighting as well. Many of these folks are brand new to politics, and having this autonomy gives them encouragement to be their own leader.
Once upon a time, Obama supporters were insurgents coalescing around various social media. Do you see, based on the kind of online networks that Tea Partiers have assembled, the possibility that they could repeat the Obama magic?
Certainly the Obama campaign had a huge presence on social media. However, it was still blessed by the candidate, by the Democratic National Committee, and there was a very well-funded infrastructure there that was able to channel this online activism into real solid boots-on-the-ground traditional political activities. We don't see that with the Tea Party. However, it's worth pointing out that that network that Obama built has lost a lot of its energy. So there's a lesson there for Tea Partiers.
One of the things you've noticed as an advantage of this kind of lattice work communications is the ability for Tea Partiers to police themselves. Tell me about that.
The activists and the big thinkers who are charting strategy for the Tea Party movements are confident that the social network will sort of rise to the challenge of rooting out elements that they deem to be casting a pall over the entire movement. For instance, you saw an element to cast out the birthers. There was a real effort to brand them as persona non grata within the Tea Party movement.
And then after Christine O'Donnell won the Republican nomination in Delaware, there was a huge pylon on none other than Karl Rove.
One of the things that really jumps out at me when I look at these various feeds is the extent to which Tea Partiers are motivated by this us against the world mentality. They thrive on being counted out. And the groundswell of energy lashing out at Karl Rove and some other Republican leaders who had suggested that they might not be inclined to support Christine O'Donnell probably did have a role in compelling some of these Republican leaders to come out and express their support, even though literally hours beforehand they were expressing some misgivings about her candidacy.
Ken, thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure.
Ken Vogel is a reporter for Politico. Earlier this week, Newsweek's Howard Fineman described the Tea Party movement as hashtag politics. The hashtag, as Twitter users know, is a short series of characters preceded by a pound sign. Use of a tag allows like-minded users to connect their tweets to an ongoing searchable discussion. One of the most well-known Tea Party hashtags is pound TCOT, which stands for Top Conservatives on Twitter. Co-founder of this Twitter-specific community is Michael Patrick Leahy. Mike, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much, Bob, for having me on here.
Tell me the origin of TCOT.
Well, after the election in November 2008, the general perception was that the left owned the internet. Now, there was one new social media tool that had come out, Twitter. So I simply put up a little website, and I made a list of the 25 top conservatives on Twitter. And I ranked the top conservatives based upon the number of followers they had. What I discovered is that conservatives on Twitter were A, lonesome, and B, competitive. They all wanted to be on the list. Over the course of about 24 hours, I had about 1,000 requests.
So literally overnight, you became a power broker.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think people misunderstand the movement. And, you know, there's been much discussion about is there a leader, is there not. I think it's fair to say that I helped organize an online community in November of 2008 that launched the Tea Party movement in February of 2009. The core values of the Tea Party movement really were developed collaboratively with thousands of everyday average folks who were on Twitter. Number one, constitutionally limited government. Number two, free markets. And number three, fiscal responsibility. And so we opposed any policies that were counter to those three core values. And the policies really started under the George Bush administration. So it's the policies that we oppose, not the person.
One thing I noticed after the O'Donnell primary win on Tuesday and Karl Rove's analysis of it was just this huge piling on of Tea Party sentiment against Karl Rove, the GOP establishment and hierarchy in particular. And it makes me wonder if the Tea Party movement is not going to tear apart the Republicans before it gets to defeat the Democrats.
I think you saw the truth in terms of the way the Tea Party movement perceives the old big government Republicans. We were not happy with the TARP bailout or the auto bailout. I think the Tea Party movement clearly represents the majority of Americans and the majority of those in both political parties. There will always be, I think, in my opinion, two political parties, but the way they are organized, who leads them and how the agenda is set, you're witnessing history as that changes this very moment.
All right, Mike. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it.
Michael Patrick Leahy is co-founder of Top Conservatives on Twitter. His new book, The Ideological Origins of the Tea Party Movement, is scheduled for publication by HarperCollins in 2011.
Coming up, a newspaper apologizes for its front page on September 11th.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last Saturday, the Portland, Maine Press Herald ran a page one story on the local observance of the last day of Ramadan. The day was September 11th. And what followed was a barrage of angry emails that a Muslim holiday would push the anniversary of the 2001 terror attacks off the front page. What followed that was a 700-word apology written by the paper's editor and publisher, Richard Connor, saying the Ramadan story should have been balanced with 9/11 coverage and handled in, quote, a more sensitive way. The apology provoked Time magazine columnist James Poniewozik to comment, "There is now one group of Americans whose peaceful religious observance cannot be noted by decent people unless it is balanced by the mention of a vile crime committed in 2001 by people with a perverted idea of the same religion from the other side of the world." The Press Herald's Richard Connor joins me. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, so what was the matter with the story that you ran, the original story?
Nothing. There was nothing wrong with our coverage of the local observance of the conclusion of Ramadan. We're proud of the way we covered it. We'll cover it again next year and next year and the next year. We did not cover the 9/11 anniversary on the 9/11 date the way that we should have. We had a lot of coverage planned for 9/12, the day after. So if you read the apology closely, in my opinion, you'll see that I supported the decision to cover Ramadan. What I questioned is how we could have essentially omitted coverage of 9/11 on the same day. I think that without doubt, some of the people who complained about the lack of 9/11 coverage were really couching anti-Muslim and anti-Islamic attitudes, but I think they're hiding behind that.
And you apologized to them. Many saw Saturday's front page story and photo regarding the local observance of the end of Ramadan as offensive. And the remainder of your 700-word mea culpa is an apology for, yes, the oversight of not covering the 9/11 anniversary, but somehow treading on their sensibilities. And I'm having trouble with the idea of you apologizing for covering the end of Ramadan.
I think you're misreading it. We will cover Ramadan locally and the observance of it from, you know, now to whenever. The apology is for not giving the play to 9/11 that many of our readers felt it should have. The two are disconnected.
I understand, but let me ask you this, please. What would you say was the preponderance of the attitudes expressed in these angry emails?
The preponderance of emails that I received were from people who said, how could you have missed the 9/11 coverage on 9/11? What motivated them to write that? I don't know.
You remarked about treading on the sensibilities of your readers. If their sensibilities were trod upon by your covering the observance of the end of Ramadan, isn't that kind of their problem?
They weren't. If you want to stick to that, you can. The emails that I received were predominantly directed at the omission of more coverage of 9/11.
You said, quote, many saw Saturday's front page story and photo regarding the local observance of the end of Ramadan as offensive, particularly on the day September 11, when our nation and the world were paying tribute to those who died in the 9/11 terrorist attack 9 years ago. Now, if that's anything other than the connection between Islam and radical Islamic terrorism, I just don't know what is.
You know what? I'm just telling you, you're wrong. Start with particularly and go forward. The reference point was 9/11. That's what it was. If you think I'm rephrasing it, then you can just keep running this tape over and over again. The people that make our decisions every day, they made a mistake on the one side. They didn't on the coverage of Ramadan. That's our position. It may not suit where you want to go, okay?
Well, how about a different sentence from your apology, Rich?
Look,
readers,
I just gave you a new statement. Go with the new one. I really don't care.
So are you retracting your 700-word apology to the readers?
No, I'm not retracting the apology to the readers for not covering 9/11.
Thank you very much. Richard Connor is the editor and publisher of the Portland Press Herald. Every technological advance has a potential downside. Social networking sites greatly expand our list of contacts, but do they erode friendships in the real world? The web provides endless information, but does it impair our ability to read long books? Nick Bilton, lead writer for the New York Times Bits blog, says no and no. His new book, I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works, says early adopters like him have turned out just fine. He says that fear of the unknown always accompanies the introduction of any new technology, like in the 1800s with the adoption of the train.
There were scientists of the day that said that if we traveled on a train over 20 miles an hour, that our bones could explode. The telephone, for example, 1876, front page of the New York Times, and the telephone debuts. And the article, you know, starts off describing what this technology is, but then goes into this long list of things that the telephone is going to do negative to society. And one of them is that people will never leave their house again. Not even a year later, out comes the phonograph. And the front page article in the New York Times about the phonograph says the telephone that was just regarded as the invention of the century is about to be eclipsed by the phonograph, where people can buy bottled quarts of conversations and they'll never leave their home again. And there's a great line that says, you know, blessed be the boy of the future who never has to learn how to read. And so we've gone through these fears just all the way through to today with computers, where we're really afraid that reading on screens is bad for us and that Twitter is going to make us stupid, and along with Google and everything else.
Well, Google making us stupid, that refers, I guess, to Nicholas Carr's piece in The Atlantic, suggesting that Google makes us stupid because it limits our scope. The whole world pays attention only to the first two or three search results and examines them only cursorily, and therefore all of the endless amount of information that is at our fingertips, we don't even use.
I respect Nicholas Carr and his writing, but I think that he's coming at this from a different generational point of view. And from myself, who's grown up on the internet and grown up with technology, you know, I still read books, and I just wrote one, which is even a longer experience than reading one. And I don't think that these things are going away. And I think it's also a change in the way stories are told in another respect. We talk about, you know, kids that don't consume long-form content, but they play video games for 4 hours a day. Isn't that long-form content? Just because they're not sitting down to read War and Peace or a history book about World War II, and instead they're playing a video game about World War II, does that mean that the one is worse than the other? And I really tried to tackle those questions and look at really what was taking place.
Another frequent criticism of the online experience, and backed up by no small amount of research, is the notion that multitasking is bad for us because we try to do more than one thing at a time with our various digital tools, and all we end up doing is rotating among these tasks and doing all of them poorly.
I think it's not as black and white as we've been told to believe. And what I found was that nobody agrees on anything when it comes to this multitasking debate, especially when it comes to media multitasking, of consuming different types of media simultaneously. If you go back to the research I discuss in the book, this thing called the cocktail party effect, of where you can be at a very rowdy cocktail party and you can concentrate on the conversation you're having, but if somebody yells your name from across the room, your brain processes it and you turn your head. And so our brain can handle, you know, processing all this information simultaneously, but there are limits to it. And what I found was that, sure, we'll never be able to text, message, and drive at the same time because it's dangerous. But there's nothing to say that it's bad if I'm watching a sports game on my television and tweeting about it, maybe even looking up some of the scores and statistics simultaneously, because it's less of a load on our brains as we're actually jumping between the same kind of content.
Now that I have a cell phone with my address book inside of it, I can't remember anybody's telephone number. Without my cell phone address book, I'm lost. Once upon a time, I knew dozens of numbers by heart. Does that not mean something?
No, because if I took your phone away and said, that's it, no more phone for Bob, you would easily be able to remember those phone numbers again. It may take a couple of days for you to transition and put your brain back into the right place that it was before, but it doesn't mean that you've rewired your brain in a way that it's permanently unable to remember phone numbers.
In your book, you talk about the plasticity of the brain, and you make a point of saying that a dissected human brain in 2010 would look exactly the same as a dissected human brain from, you know, let's say 1970, right?
Yeah, so I was actually interviewing a very well-known neuroscientist around plasticity, and I said, so have our brains evolved? And he quickly interrupted me, and he said, our brains don't evolve in 10 years or 20 years or even a couple of thousand years. Evolution takes place over millions of years with the human brain, right? What we're seeing happening is our brains adapt. Gary Small, who's at UCLA, he put people in these fMRI brain scanners, and people that were in their 50s and 60s, and he scanned their brain when they were reading a book, and he scanned their brain when they were surfing the web, and he found that the web was a much more engaging experience for the brain. But what he found was that the people that had never used the web before, after about 7 to 10 days, their brains adapted and rewired themselves, and it's the same thing that's happening when any new technology comes out.
Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Nick Bilton is the lead writer for the New York Times Bits blog and author of I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works.
There's that old saw, you are what you eat. Imagine that at the end of each day, someone handed you an itemized list of every food you'd consumed. Now imagine the media equivalent. Yeah, maybe you'd rather not know, but Ethan Zuckerman wants to know. He's a senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and he believes to really know ourselves in the modern age, we have to track what he calls our personal information flow. Ethan, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Brooke.
So first of all, why? I mean, what do you suspect about the way you personally or people in general receive information from the media, and what do you think that measuring it would show?
Well, I myself bought a little personal pedometer the other day, and I probably would have told you that I walk 2 or 3 miles a day. Now that I actually track it, I discover that I'm mostly a lazy slob who sits on the couch, and that's a useful thing to find out. what I'm now trying to do is apply that same sort of logic of self-examination to the world of media. And I'm hoping to test a theory that I've argued for a couple of years now, which is this idea that we may get less information about international news, about the world beyond our own borders at this moment in time than we did in an age before the internet. And I figured if I'm going to go around and make this assertion, and there's some good support for this assertion, I should try to look at my own media diet. And then also I hope to set up an experiment that other people could voluntarily participate in so that people could look at what they're basically taking in and decide whether or not they're happy with the media that they're getting.
So we're talking about measuring all of the information that a person receives in the course of the day, whether on a website or in a conversation with someone on the street, random shot of a billboard, cataloging all of that and analyzing it, because a lot of our media is pretty passively consumed. We don't necessarily even choose it.
Well, I'm trying to do two things. I am trying to keep a diary of the off-computer media that I encounter. When I'm listening to the radio, when I'm talking to people on the telephone, when I'm having conversations, I'm just trying to make notes in a little file. When I'm on the computer, there's a wonderful program called Rescue Time, which is designed to help you decide what time you're spending online that's productive and what time you're spending online that's wasting time. And if you set it up, it'll come and nag you and, you know, tell you that you've been spending too much time reading about football and not enough time getting your work done. But it also turns out to be a very effective tool for tracking what websites you visited, how long you've spent on each of them. And then you can dump all this data together and start building a portrait of where your information is coming from.
How does this tool, this Rescue Time, know that you're wasting your time?
When you first install it, it's a little bit judgmental. It asks you to list the three activities that you think are the most productive and then the three activities that you think are the least productive. And I remember telling it that I thought encountering news and opinion content was the second most productive thing I did, at which point Rescue Time said, really? Most people think that that's a terrible waste of time. I'm not trying to do this so much that I have a computerized nag that bothers me every time I look up Red Sox scores. I'm really doing this more because it's a nice way of tracking all that online behavior past. One of the problems with active tracking is that people lie all the time. Nielsen figured this out years ago. If you become a Nielsen family, I remember doing this. My wife and I did this about a dozen years ago and kept a little paper diary. And we recorded ourselves as watching more PBS that month than during any month we've ever watched television. The active recording tends to force you to change your behavior. So I'd really love to get as much passive data as possible.
There are these things called people meters that people wear that track what they're listening to. It's passive, but what it can't tell you is the substance of what you're listening to.
Well, that's correct, but ideally what you'd be able to do if you could put together a really good media diary where I'm making entries and saying, okay, I listened to Morning Edition in the shower this morning from, let's say, 7 to 7:10. I'd like to be able to enter that into my media diary, have a tool retrieve what stories were played on my local NPR affiliate during that time, grab the text from the web of those stories, or at least the keywords of them, and then be able to do an analysis of it. Because what I really want to be able to do at the end of the month is ask questions like, how much hard news have I gotten versus entertainment content? What parts of the world have I heard about?
So what have you learned so far? Anything as significant as what you learned when you got your pedometer?
Predictably, I've got huge blind spots. I read an enormous amount about Africa because it's a part of the world that I know a lot about, have traveled to quite a bit. I read almost nothing about Latin America. I'm also finding that while I think of myself as someone who very actively looks for information, in the course of an ordinary day, almost all the information that I'm getting comes to me on the front page of a couple of news sites that I view or over the radio. We think in a digital age that we have a great deal of control over what information we're getting. It's an interesting reminder to me of how important the forces of editors and curation still are to us.
Do you think that there's such a thing as an ideal media consumer, the person that perhaps you want to be?
I'm not sure that there's a good picture of the ideal media consumer. I do think at the same time that there's the possibility of having enough information that you can be an informed civic actor. One of the things that worries me, Brooke, is that there's a lot of people in the media working very, very hard to try to present important hard news, whether it's statehouse reporting, whether it's investigative journalism, and it's not clear what grabs people's attention. You can't assume that just because the information has flowed past me, whether it's on the computer screen, whether it's on the television, whether it's on the radio, that I've necessarily consumed it. But if I click a link, if I open up a web page, if I look for more information on it, that's a fairly good indicator that that piece of information registered with me and I took action based on that.
Do you think that our role as actors has changed?
Our roles have changed enormously now that it's so easy to create media. I think a lot of us, whether we think of ourselves as doing it or not, end up being curators. We curate by putting links up on Twitter, by posting things on Facebook, by sending them via email to our friends. We're all becoming editors, trying to figure out how we're getting information and how we're amplifying it and passing it on to other people, for me, would be the heart of this experiment.
Ethan, thank you so much.
Always great to talk to you, Brooke.
Ethan Zuckerman is a senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at lendingtree.com or 800-555-TREE. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with an update. After last summer's post-election demonstrations in Iran, a programmer named Austin Heap invented Haystack, software he said would help Iranian activists access banned websites, encrypt their conversations, and most importantly, hide such activity within innocuous material that would not arouse the suspicions of censors. This spring, he announced that a version of Haystack was being tested by users in Iran and would soon roll out in 3 other countries besides. And he brandished a waiver from the U.S. government to distribute Haystack in Iran as further evidence that the software was a success.
Media outlet after media outlet, including us, celebrated Heap until 2 weeks ago when technology writer Yevgeny Morozov cast aspersions on Haystack's overly ambitious claims. By last Sunday, a small group of cybersecurity experts finally did what hadn't yet been done by a third party. They obtained a copy of the software, tested it, and declared it fundamentally flawed. By Monday morning, Haystack had been turned off. Iranian users were warned off, and its lead developer quit, and its board of directors disbanded. The post-mortem assigning of blame is well underway, and we covered much of that last week with Morozov. This week, we wanted to talk to one of the cybersecurity experts who checked the software, Jacob Applebaum, a hacker and advocate for another encryption and anonymity tool named Tor. He said the first sign of Haystack's failings was the secrecy surrounding it. And then he saw the software itself.
The tool that I looked at with a team of researchers this last weekend, it made some mistakes that I believe would allow the Iranian government or other people to potentially find all people who ever use this software, which is exactly the opposite of the claim that Haystack, the Haystack Network, and Austin Heap specifically said. Because it is a tool only marketed for revolution in Iran, it's extremely dangerous to be caught using that tool. Unfortunately, I know for a fact that people were able to get copies of Haystack, and those people did not have warnings, and they knew only what was in the media.
One of the object lessons from Haystack was that the press was totally seduced by the story of its effectiveness. Our guest last week, Yevgeny Morozov, chalked this up in large part to what he calls cyber utopianism. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I'll tell you, I was extremely disappointed to see the media react the way that they did to Haystack. It seems quite clear to me that absolutely none of them had any idea about what they were talking about, and all of them wanted it to be true. And that's fair. I also, for a time, was excited. But the sad thing is that the media seems to lack contacts with experts. But even worse, it seems to lack an understanding that it needs to make contact with those experts. The media has a responsibility, not necessarily to evaluate every piece of software before they endorse it, but definitely to do some investigative journalism about something when there are human lives at risk. They can ask hard questions, such as, do you have an open design that has been peer-reviewed? Do you have a diverse set of users? Do you have a decentralized architecture or a centralized one that allows you to monitor everyone and everything that uses your tool? Does it make promises like magically encrypting the internet or making everything perfectly secure? Is it easy to update? Do you do security through obscurity? Do you say, oh, we can't give you a copy of this because, well, that would be telling. If that is in fact asked by the media, I think that you will see charlatans on purpose or charlatans by accident shrink away.
Now, you're the chief advocate for Tor. That's a software that both encrypts and circumvents censorship. What exactly does Tor allow users to do?
Well, I want to make it clear that this is not a Haystack versus Tor thing. And one of the things that we do with Tor that is different, I believe, is that we openly operate. We share our specifications. We share our source code. We're open about all of our funders. And while we do definitely have the ability to circumvent some kinds of censorship, we are primarily an anonymity tool. Any circumvention, anonymity, or privacy tool must have a diverse set of users. I prefer to help people that work for social justice, but this is my own personal preference. I'll basically train anybody in anonymity that needs it. I met with some Swedish police when I was last in Stockholm. Other people at the Tor Project have done trainings for the police in the United States. The police use it to hunt down child pornographers. It's useful for being able to send a message, leak a document. So there are many, many things that we do, but we never, ever claim that you couldn't find a Tor user.
Now, Tor tries to offer, in a very open way, a certain amount of protection when you're online. If your code is entirely open for all to see, how can it be effective at all?
You, for example, will install Tor on your computer. You use the internet at home. And the people watching you locally would see you connect to a server. The first server would know who you are potentially in terms of coming from a connection you pay for at home that has your name on it. You go from there to a second server. The second server only knows about the first server. Now they no longer know who you are. The second server routes your traffic to the third server. And that is where you connect to, for example, Amazon.com. Amazon.com only sees the third server. Now, whatever you tell Amazon at that point is, of course, your decision. But you no longer implicitly tell them anything other than the fact that you're coming from the Tor network. So the first knows who you are, but not where you're going. The second doesn't know where you are coming from or where you're going. And the third knows where you're going, but not who you are or where you came from.
Do you worry about the cover that Tor could give somebody committing atrocious acts online?
I think that it's extremely important that we give everyone the same ability to speak freely without fear of repercussion, without fear of retribution. And yes, it is possible that it could be misused, but I believe the problem of bad speech is not solved by censoring speech or by tracking people down and harming them, but rather it is solved with more speech.
Tor is a good example of a project nurtured by the U.S. government, by the Naval Research Lab, and that is still funded in part by the government, that has gone on to enable things to happen that the government may no longer find in its interest. For example, Tor is what allows WikiLeaks to shield itself from the identity of people leaking its information. Do you recognize competing interests here, or are you in favor of anonymity no matter what?
I think it's important to note that it doesn't matter where we get our money from. Everything we do is in the open and is disclosed. I won't comment on WikiLeaks, but I will comment on Tor. Yes, you can use Tor to speak freely on the internet. And yes, someone might use Tor to leak information. And I personally have no problem with that, just the same way that I wouldn't mind if Daniel Ellsberg had used the U.S. Postal Service to hand over the Pentagon Papers. I think that this is a neutral technology in this regard.
with the right tools, can the internet deliver open information and anonymity?
As my friend Luciano, he lives in China, as he says, you know, we used to have one big internet, and now we have lots of little broken internets. And I think that that's part of the issue. Circumvention is fantastic for escaping your country.
Being able to circumvent the censors in your country.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually deal, however, with book censorship, magazine, newspaper censorship. It does not help you to get back into your country to read the information that has been erased. And that's part of the reason that Tor is not just a circumvention tool, but rather an anonymity tool. Because we think that it's important for people to be able to be anonymous and to publish things without those people being silenced. I'd like to think that in the future, we will treat privacy as a human right, as it's quite clear that it's a necessity for dignity. But I'd also like to think that we treat internet censorship as a trade barrier, and potentially governments should sanction places that are effectively oppressing their people with digital versions of the Berlin Wall. And while that's a little bit hyperbolic, there are people that live behind extremely restrictive firewalls, people who are potentially arrested for the things that they do on the internet, and not even necessarily the things that they say on the internet, but just the things that they read about.
Jacob, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on your show. I very much appreciate it.
Jacob Applebaum is an advocate and developer of the Tor project and an independent computer security hacker.
One of Hollywood's greatest conundrums is how to represent foreign speech in American films. Filmmakers have to toe the line between verisimilitude and being able to attract an audience that might not be interested in reading subtitles for 2 hours. To do so, filmmakers have, over the history of the movie industry, come up with a variety of creative ways to depict foreign languages. Eric Hines, film critic for Slate.com, says that the way a foreign language is depicted in a film can fundamentally alter the way a story is told and the way the audience perceives both characters and place.
At the end of the day, you're serving the story one way or the other. In the films in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were a little bit more lax about it. Like a film that I discussed, The Shop Around the Corner, is set in Budapest, and yet everybody speaks as if they're from different neighborhoods in New York. I don't think the audience really cares because the writing is so good and the characters are so well drawn.
Still hanging around the shop, eh, Mr. Marchek?
Yeah.
Can't get away from here, huh?
Well, you better hurry home, son. You're probably celebrating Christmas with your mother and father. Am I wrong?
Yes, Mr. Marchek. See that girl over there in the corner?
Yeah.
Well, I'm her Santa Claus. Good night, Mr. Marchek.
You know, 60, 70 years ago, audiences were sort of more able to accept that kind of leap, because they're coming out of sort of a silent tradition where you're not hearing language one way or the other.
60-some years after The Shop Around the Corner, director Sofia Coppola made Marie Antoinette, starring Kirsten Dunst, and made a similar choice.
Oh, my brother, I'm devastated by the news of our mother's death. You alone are left to me in Austria, which is and will always be so dear to me. I embrace you.
The first instinct is to say, how come there's no French accents? Why is nobody speaking in French? Yet, I think in this case that her dramatic choice is an interesting one because Kirsten Dunst is basically playing Kirsten Dunst because she's playing a sort of sheltered starlet. So I think dramatically it actually makes a bit of sense.
If using the foreign language is out of the question, there are ways to suggest foreign, and accents is, I guess, the key one. But even that is done several different ways. For example, for some reason, an English accent is considered a universal substitute. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples?
The most recent example is Prince of Persia, which on one hand, it's absolutely absurd to hear Jake Gyllenhaal speak in this attempted upper crust British accent, even though he's playing a Prince of Persia. And yet it kind of works. We hear this storybook Old English, And that does sort of stand in for an American audience for just about anything that's not American. And for certain stories, that's kind of all you need. You don't need for this teenage fantasy film to be historically accurate. You just need to sort of convey a sense of foreignness. And to American ears, at least, an English accent serves that purpose.
Can we talk about the accents of the British Empire? So many American actors have just gone down in flames.
Sure.
Trying to be British, to be Australian, to be Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a Hall of Shame?
Brad Pitt in a movie called The Devil's Own with Harrison Ford, in which he plays a Northern Irish terrorist with just a horrendous Northern Irish accent.
You're a stupid man, Mr. Burke. You're only seeing me standing between you and the money. But you're forgetting about the thousand other men standing behind me. Are you with me there, love?
I want to talk about the flip side of it, which is when foreign actors appear in American films as American characters and are simply incapable of pulling it off. I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Caine in a movie called The Weatherman.
I thought you were trying to improve matters with Noreen, if not reconcile.
I am. What did Frost say?
He wants to speak to me in about 10 minutes. Would you get me a coffee, Dave, so I can warm up?
Why do directors make these casting decisions?
I guess you're thinking on some level, Michael Caine is the best actor we can get. We want him in our film. He can help our film. He can help market our film. But the idea that you're going to ask the sort of audience to sort of accept that kind of leap, for there to be this tonal disconnect throughout the entire film, even though it's Michael Caine and you want to see him, the story kind of falls apart.
Some movies actually split the difference by having characters who are multilingual. Recent examples, Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. The German villain, Hans Landa, speaks French, Italian, German, and English throughout the film, but they always manage to make the English language dialogue organic to the story.
Tarantino is just a master at this. I think Inglourious Basterds, from first to last, is this masterclass on how to sort of use language as an opportunity dramatically. That Hans Landa character throughout, he uses his multilingual abilities as his greatest weapon. That first scene of the film, what seems like a protracted Tarantino delaying tactic, is actually completely dramatically essential. He uses his bilingual abilities to sort of ensnare his prey.
Are there films that have actually addressed the language issue by being transparent about the problem the filmmaker faces?
Traditionally, what's interesting is that a lot of comedies have been the films that sort of most directly address the problems of foreign speech, or at least call attention to the absurdities of translation and subtitling. Like The Great Dictator, 8 years after the advent of sound, is already having great fun with the idea of translation, because this dictator is speaking a total gibberish version of German, and there's this sort of sober off-screen translator translating what he's saying.
Democracy stunk.
Democracy is fragrant.
Liberty stunk.
Liberty is odious.
Free sprechen stunk.
Freedom of speech is objectionable.
Dominia, mit der Krutze haben in der Welt.
To your mind, what do you think is the best solution to maintain verisimilitude, or at least to prolong the willing suspension of disbelief?
I think that it does come down to how successfully the film works on its own terms. And I think if you can sell what you're doing on your own terms, the audience will go with you. To me, like even a film like The Shop Around the Corner, I find that even remotely problematic, because there is no doubt that there is a reality that's being inhabited on screen. And that's what I want to see.
Eric, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Eric Hines is a writer and film critic for Slate.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Brett Jaspers, and Alex Goldman. with more help from Nerida Brownlee and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Technical direction was provided by Jennifer Munson, and our engineer this week was Robert Granis.
Kat Tier Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our top dog. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.